recommend an article. Sorry, of course, I'll get a copy of that.
Yes,
Oh, will I?
here, I'm going to give you, is it on now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm going to give you all of the pertinent documentation that I have, including correspondence with the Navajo Tribal Council, the Marine Corps, the Commissioner of Indian Affairs, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and all of the factors that became part of a fascinating chapter that culminated on June 28, 1969.
Would you tell me what you think I should include in a letter of inquiry? I mean, that just the, as you say, the guts of the thing.
Well, let me just see, let me say this. Who performed valiantly for the battle from Guadalcanal to Okinawa.
Will you name the battles?
Yes, yes. Peleliu, Saipan, Tinian, Guam, Tarawa, Iwo Jima, Guadalcanal. And what it amounted to was that we were having trouble with communications. In jungle warfare, you don't have time to cipher, decipher. And so it was recommended by one gent named Philip Johnston that a code that could not be broken might possibly be the Navajo Indian language, because at that time it was considered the only hidden language in the world. Only 28 people in the entire world could speak Navajo outside of the Navajos themselves. And so 30 men were tried out. It was a successful test. And before the war was over, somewhere around 350 Navajos were recruited into the Marine Corps. They were attached to every platoon. They were aboard the ships. They were able to communicate with their fellow Navajos who were on the landing parties and in the jungles. And there are many who consider that we may never have taken Iwo Jima were it not for the Navajos. And I'll document all of this with material that you'll get. Mm-hmm. Our job with the 4th Marine Division Association was nothing more than to uncover, find these men, and perhaps put the spotlight once again on a fascinating chapter in American military history that really never received the publicity that it should have gotten.
And that was for the reunion in June of 1969.
The 22nd annual reunion of the 4th Marine Division. Mm-hmm. And so we had to start finding the Navajos. Where do you find them after 25 years? Where are they? How many are still living? What do we do to get them? So we enlisted the help of the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Navajo Tribal Council.
Where is the Navajo Tribal Council located? Where
at
the headquarters?
At Window Rock, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And we sent a letter to Raymond Nakai, N-A-K-A-I, the Honorable Raymond Nakai, the chairman of the Navajo Nation, asking whether he could be on hand to accept a medallion. He said he would. The Commissioner of Indian Affairs at the time was asked whether he would be on hand, and he said he would.
They had actually served with the Marine Corps, had they?
No. In the case of Robert Bennett, he had been a Marine.
But this, these were honors in the name of the Navajos.
Right. The reason we asked Raymond Nakai to be there was because we didn't have a medallion for every one of the Navajos, mm-hmm. and so mm-hmm. he would be getting it as a symbolic
yes.
honor
mm-hmm.
for all of them. Mm-hmm. And the Marine Corps, headquarters Marine Corps, was very anxious to cooperate and provided an airlift to bring out a representative number of them. And these men were our guests for 4 days. We
just 4 days. Did many bring their families?
We didn't have the facilities for that, mm-hmm. but there were still those who made arrangements for their families
mm-hmm.
to come, and they did have their families here. But we had the medallion made. We got permission from the modern-day counterpart of Russell and Remington, the two great Western historical painters. And this this modern-day counterpart is a fellow named Joe Grandee.
G-R-A-N-D-E-E.
Right, he's the man who made the paintings for the Borax Mule teams.
Mm-hmm.
His paintings are owned by Regan, Frankie
mm-hmm.
Lane.
Mm-hmm.
Is he still living?
He's still living and is a young man and a brilliant artist.
Where is he located?
Fort Worth, Texas. Arlington, Texas, actually.
He is the one who painted the picture.
He was the one who painted the picture we used as the basis for our medallion.
Yeah.
I called him on the phone. I introduced myself to him. I told him what we wanted, and I thought he was going to start crying.
Mm-hmm.
The fact, because he is a student of Western history, and he knows all about peace medals. And he's got one of the greatest collections of Indian lore and costumes and regalia and cavalry outfits. He's really a student of the West.
He's white. He's not red.
Not
an Indian.
No, he's
mm-hmm.
white man.
Mm-hmm.
And when I told him that one of his paintings was being considered as the basis for a medal to the Indians, he flipped.
Didn't see why he went.
And so he gave us permission for us to use it.
Don't snap that off.
Chapter of the 4th Marine Division. So, of course, they may think that you're merely a press agent for a Marine Division, of which there probably are a lot, and they may miss the point completely. You can tell them that you've been given the full cooperation, promised the full cooperation of the division that produced the medallion for the Navajo Code Talkers, and that you are the only one that has been authorized on a civilian level. And will have access to the personal and private files of the division and the Navajo Code Talkers
mm-hmm.
for this purpose. If this means anything, it should.
Well, it would have to.
It means that you've got the document.
I mean, it has. That gives it authority, you
mm-hmm.
see.
Yes, you know, the project should have great interest for the magazine because it would be a scoop.
I would think so.
I think
and
I
if
think
you
it
could
would
convince
because
them
it's a one of a kind.
That's right.
Yeah.
No.
And when they find that she does have the data and would be about the only one that with it,
mm-hmm.
well, then they wouldn't dilly-dally around, but would go ahead and say, yes, proceed, let's see it.
Yeah, mm-hmm. of course, a lot of them will say, some editors will say, we'll sit on speculation,
mm-hmm.
and which means that if it lives up to what you say it's going
it's got
to live
all,
up to.
It's got all the pluses,
uh-huh.
even if a guy says, you send it to me and I'll read it. You've got it made because this
uh-huh.
is such an exciting, fascinating story
mm-hmm.
to where I've seen what's happened with this story mm-hmm. around the country. I've talked to two stations and they said, gee,
mm-hmm.
I'd like to do a documentary
mm-hmm.
on it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like that.
Oh, it's fantastic.
On something like this, this station, they're talking about $12,000, $15,000 a
yes.
time.
Uh-huh. That's right. Of course, this the thing is so, it's such a tremendous thing that it can be treated a number of different ways, and, mm-hmm. and you won't lose anything. I mean, there could be a television documentary, and there could be an article.
I want to, if I may, and this, I wish you'll catch this on here.
It is on, isn't it?
Is it on?
Yes,
mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would hope that the amount of good that this article can do the Marine Corps at this point is not important to me. The amount of good that this article will do the 4th Marine Division Association, with the gung-ho, our division did the job,
mm-hmm.
That's not important to me. What is important to me in this whole thing at this point is what good it may do the Indian Nation. What good it may do the Navajos. Too often today when they read in the adjacent cities to the Navajo or the Hopi, or the Seminole, or the Apache, or the various Indian tribe areas, it's only because Indians got in trouble, or got drunk,
mm-hmm.
or have had difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
I would like very much for this story to reflect the new Indian today, who's very anxious to pull himself up by his bootstraps and forge ahead, and great progress is being made among the largest tribe in the United States, which happens to be the Navajos. If there's any way of reflecting that which is good for the Indians as against as the backdrop of this story without ruining the story, I'd like that to be
mm-hmm.
precedent.
Most anything you do, Lee, in this category would have that constructive effect.
I think so.
And I don't think it needs to be a,
I don't think
it
has
to be
sound.
A Sunday school story.
You don't have
yeah.
to punch
know,
it.
Yeah.
It'll take
it.
Care of
no,
itself.
I just think
yeah.
it takes
mm-hmm.
care of itself.
I think perhaps you're right.
Mm-hmm. I think there's another thing.
Like
I think.
No, thanks.
I think that, does anything that will strengthen the confidence of the people of the nation in the armed services.
Yes.
Right now.
You're right.
I mean, that wouldn't come out in the story, but I mean, I think it might have a secondary effect,
mm-hmm.
you know. The
what's important
the clever,
here?
The cleverness of the
what,
whole idea.
What happened?
Ingenuity.
What's important? I'll send you the little article that told about how this idea was presented to the
yes.
Corps and how they accepted
yes,
it and how they questioned it and how
yeah,
they figured,
uh-huh.
oh, this is kooky, it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll give you all kinds of documentation, but I'm going to give you, in many instances, only one of a kind. So I'll hope that when you're through with it, you shoot the original documentation back to me.
Yes.
And use
yes.
it for, you know, because I don't go around duplicating this stuff. I don't even have a machine.
Mm-hmm.
But when I got a good story on the Code Talkers, I just put it in a file.
I see.
Now I want to take that file and turn it over to you. And when you're through writing your story, the only thing I'll ask is that you return that stuff
yes.
to me. If you want to make duplicates of it,
of course
that's okay with me.
I could do that.
That's okay with
and,
me.
And I mean, I might do that
I have
and
no
get
reason.
It back to you because I would hate for it to be lost.
Yeah. I'd have no reason for you not to have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's nothing of that
mm-hmm.
secretive in nature, except that I have not given this story to anyone else, with the exception of Colonel Bixby, who was with the Public Affairs Unit in Chicago, who I said, Colonel, you've got the time to put it together. I'm going to give you all the elements,
mm-hmm.
and let's get something in Leatherneck. I've already talked with them, which is the Marine Corps magazine.
Yes.
I said, I've already talked with them. They've already agreed to run it. You just have to send it in.
And he did.
He sent it in, and Marine, and in their morgue, they had pictures of the Navajos right there.
Well, and it was a good article.
It turned out, I thought it was good.
Yes.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And it used material that I had used as press secretary of the 4th Division.
It'd be good if you could even see that, too.
Well, he's
yes,
he's
I'm
going
to send
that
to
that.
You.
You can use
every bit of it, and you can just word it in your own words. Because what he has is factual.
Back to, I think we might talk a little bit about where this might go. I think Reader's Digest might buy it, but then they do not use pictures, and I think it would lose some of its story value.
Yes,
if it,
but they will
have
follow
pictures.
Other magazines. Get it in a major magazine.
Well, I might
magazine,
get it in a major magazine.
And let them convince
mm-hmm.
it in their face.
I think
now,
the way you write it would have to be important. Whether or not Look, Life, Newsweek, well, not Newsweek or Time.
No,
they will
no.
only do a very roughy,
and they,
rough, sketchy
and they
thing.
Have staff. They have too much staff.
They've got staff, but I'm thinking of True.
Now, I've never written for True, but I mean, I've never even slanted anything for True. It's a good magazine.
Check.
It's a.
Oh, it's very popular.
I could read.
It's a gutsy man's magazine.
That's right.
And
it's the kind of one that would might carry it because they're always doing about Fräulein's maidens, you know.
Oh, that's
the,
right. Yes.
Time wouldn't be the best. They do a news item, but if they did it, they'd have their own writer take it and put it in this Time language.
That's
yes,
right.
And
that
put it
yeah.
back.
Yeah.
They
it
do it in about it five
it.
Paragraphs.
It'd be stereotyped,
right.
you
yeah,
see.
It wouldn't be any good.
And you
no.
couldn't get the...
curiously enough, there's magazines, not Vogue necessarily, but there's magazines today that you just never suspect might be interested in something like this.
That's true. You know, I don't know whether you would object to it being in what would be a more or less a woman's magazine like McCall's.
I was going to say McCall's.
But
that's
McCall's,
what I had in mind.
Well, McCall's might be interested, and they don't just treat homemaking and cooking and that sort of thing. They have
oh yeah.
Have, they have
there's women. Others.
And then Reader's Digest might be interested.
Now there's another thing. It might go into a travel magazine because mm-hmm. anything that has to do with Window Rock, Arizona, and the beautiful country and
mm-hmm.
all this jazz,
mm-hmm.
It might very well go into a supplementary article in a Diners Club magazine.
Mm-hmm.
All the credit cards now, Carte Blanche, have their own cards.
Mm-hmm.
You may want to send it as a story on Frontier Airlines. Or as a story for one of the airlines that covers Albuquerque, Gallup area. You'd have
except
to
then you wouldn't get your national coverage. Well,
no.
yes, in a way you would, because
pretty good coverage,
everybody,
though,
a lot of people...
A major airline.
Yes, but...
Is it United that has a...
You mean the Mainliner?
Yes,
yeah,
Mainliner.
The Mainliner magazine.
Yeah, Mainliner is a good one for
mm-hmm.
it. Because it deals with a part of the country and the men who did their job. I'm just throwing ideas at you as
mm-hmm.
to possibilities.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of magazines, now like McCall's, that are read by the people who buy for Reader's Digest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just trying to think of the best coverage you could get
mm-hmm.
on the story, if you could get a double coverage. For instance, that is one of the. It would be a beautiful Reader's Digest story. However, and they pay very well. But I like the idea of the use of pictures.
I'd
and I just
pictures,
think that we ought
Reader's
to.
Let Reader's Digest come in second.
Let them come in second if they would be willing.
Often. Usually do.
Mm-hmm. They're keeping a very short story of mine. They've kept it a long time.
Really?
Well, in fact, they have two or three now that they say. We're putting in our files. It's good enough to use if we can find a spot for it.
But they can keep some short things an awful long time.
I know they can.
3 years ago, they're still
really?
Yeah, so.
Well, the Navajo Code Talker story is a fascinating story that I have never seen handled. What makes it fascinating is that this country was in trouble. Here was an Indian nation that not only discovered suddenly, quite by accident, that they were in a position to help directly, but then voted through their Navajo Tribal Council a resolution urging their young men to join the Marine Corps because they were needed.
Mm-hmm.
That is a very poignant
that's
point.
That's a very
you know, it's a here they did something about it.
It's amazing to me that we haven't read about this before.
It's amazing
because
to a lot of people, because in putting this whole project together, I talked with a lot of people in order to do it. And it was a massive project, not only to take care of a reunion with 500 men who came in from all across the country, but to put together the logistics of getting a plane out to Window Rock, getting these men in, making sure that somebody was with them for four days and four nights.
Because they weren't used to the big city and
they
all of its ways, you know.
understand the, you know, the apprehension on the part of some of the people. What kind of fellows would be coming in? What would happen to them when they came to the big city? Well, it turned out they were better gentlemen than our own boys.
Mm-hmm.
They were great. They were beautiful men.
What stage were they from? More than
they were primarily from Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah.
Yes.
Fort Defiance, Arizona, and Window Rock primarily.
Mm-hmm.
But they came in from Portland, Oregon. They came in from Los Angeles. They came in from several areas. And when I went back to the Navajo Tribal, this took place June 28th. I was invited to the Navajo Tribal Fair, Labor Day, which is the end of August, to make a presentation to the chairman in front of the fairgrounds. And every one of these code talkers that was in Chicago was there in his tribal gear, wearing his medallion.
Oh, isn't that what that beautiful?
Did you get photographs of that?
I got movies of it.
Mm-hmm.
I'll show them to you someday.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what happened with the spotlight on the code talkers. And I will, as soon as I get home, send to you the pertinent documentation I have on this. You can duplicate it and send it back. Because
that's what I'd rather do.
There's a great story there.
There is. You want to turn it off now?
Great story. Our headquarters was later reproduced by a friend of Grandee's, who later became his agent, as a matter of fact. And they reproduced this painting. We were selling the painting.
How did they reproduce it?
They reproduced it through a regular fine printing process. It cost about $7,000. Because they were selling these paintings.
Uh-huh.
Matter of fact, they're trying to get a postage stamp made
uh-huh.
with this thing. And they were selling them for the first few months and gave us the proceeds. They made a $1,000 donation to our scholarship fund
uh-huh.
from this thing, which was part of the excitement of
uh-huh.
this.
I see what you mean by reproducing. That is...
It was
the kind that you...
Oh, yeah. Now, yeah. 48 by 60 or larger is the original, about the size of your wall here
mm-hmm.
in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And the reproduction is about the size of this window.
Oh.
It's a beautiful thing. You all just flip when you see
it. Well, gee, you know?
You'd say... Here's a suggestion for an entirely different kind of labor.
Bring the pink.
Here's a suggestion for an entirely different kind of Labor Day. You've been to Europe, and you've been on picnic, and you've been out here, and you've been out there. Does the name Window Rock, Arizona mean anything to you? Well, it may or may not. But Window Rock, Arizona is the capital of the Navajo Nation.
Mm-hmm.
And every Labor Day, they have a Navajo tribal fair against the backdrop of the magnificent blue sky and the great mountains of New Mexico and Arizona. And then you continue and say, now this year, in 1970, their Navajo tribal fair will be more exciting than ever, because the stars of this particular one will be the Navajo Code Talkers, all wearing their proud medallions, who will be the stars of the longest parade in tribal history. They will this is a fact, in 1970.
Oh.
And that's what makes it an exciting
oh.
travel 5 minutes. In other words,
oh.
you're talking about domestic, you're talking about Arizona, you're talking about the Navajo Nation. You're talking about a Navajo tribal fair. You're talking about a great parade led by the Marine Corps Band and the Navajo Code Talkers wearing their magnificent medallions that they received for their heroic work in World War II.
Marine Corps Band.
Oh, yeah, the Marine Corps Band is going to be there in 1970. And
listen, you have to go tomorrow morning, do you? Thank you, you come back.
I'll be back before you know it.
Well, you come back. Listen, I'm going to cover these up.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
Wow.
June, will be worth the trip. That's my thought here.
Well, it's an idea.
In October 1901, my father made a trip to Washington, taking with him two Navajo Indians, and I went along for active purposes. At that time, I was 9 years old. My only friends for 5 years had been Navajo children, and I spoke their language like an Indian. Through the Indian Rights Association in Washington, my father had arranged to have an interview with President Theodore Roosevelt and informed him of the tragic situation in the Navajo country, where white stockmen were trying to evict the Navajos from public domain lands they had occupied for generations. That trip was eventful in many ways. For instance, when we stopped over in Kansas City for several days, these two Navajos had their first opportunity to see the inside of a white man's house, a modern home with all of its marvels and its incredible creations. There was a white button on the wall. When you pressed it with your finger, a great, brilliant sun blazed in the ceiling. And then, in the room where they cooked the meals, there was a big iron table. And when you turned a white candle on it and touched the match, here was wind that burned. They had never heard a wind that burned before. But the strangest and most marvelous thing of all was located in the smallest room of that house. It was a huge cauldron, a big kettle, the biggest kettle I have ever seen. And it was almost as round as a man and nearly twice his width. So they stood there and looked at it, and one of them said, "Well, now, what do you cook in that big kettle?" And their host pointed out that there was no place for a fire, but that only added to their puzzle. And they said, "Well, what can it possibly be used for? There's no place to build a fire under." So their host very kindly and carefully explained that they turned these two handles, this one to release hot water and the other one to release cold water. That was hard to believe until our host showed them that it was really true. Turn this one and hot water came out of a small pipe. Turn the other one and the water was cold. So they let that water run until this kettle was about half full of warm water. And when our host got to that point, their eyes were fairly agog with amazement. And they said, "Well, you fill it to half full of water, and what's that for?" "Well," said our host, "a man who wants to be clean takes off all of his clothes, gets into the water, and washes himself. He takes a bar of soap and rubs it all over his body. Then he rinses off the soap, gets out of the kettle, and dries himself with a rough towel. Well, I bet you if you stood there and regarded that kettle with great amazement. And finally, he turned around to my father and said, "Would it be all right with your friend if I dry that?" Our good host, Mr. Miller, was delighted to have him try it. And so, at the age of 65, Dr. King Peel had his first bath. Now there was another and smaller fixture in this bathroom. It was similar to the one he had used on the train that brought him to Kansas City. But he had not become fully accustomed to using this strange fixture. He much preferred the fixtures of nature, such as he had been accustomed to all his life. So one night he got up, left his bed, and went out of doors. This was the last of October, and the temperature was down near the freezing point. It was really quite cold outside. He was wearing nothing but his G-string. So he went out the door, closed the door behind him, found an ornamental bush beside the house, and accommodated himself in the way to which he had been accustomed all his life. Then, having done so, he felt much better, much more comfortable, started back toward the door. But when he reached that door, he found it had been locked from the inside, and he couldn't turn the handle. So he stood there at that door and scratched. He had never learned how to knock on a door, so he stood there and scratched with his fingernails. The scratching went on and on for quite a while until Mr. Miller woke up, thought that some neighbor's dog had come to his door and was scratching and trying to get in. He listened to it for quite a while and then decided that he couldn't go to sleep until that scratching stopped. So he got up from his bed and went downstairs to the front door. He was going to chase the dog away so he could sleep in peace. But when he opened that door, he saw a surprising sight. There was touching his tail without a stitch on, except that little G-string, standing in front of him outside the door. And as soon as that door swung ajar, touching his tail ran past him and dashed up the stairs to his bedroom. And from that time on, he learned to use the smaller and much more mysterious fixtures in the bathroom. In due course, we continued our journey to Washington and had a conference with President Theodore Roosevelt. This proved to be an event of great historic importance. But when the President learned about the plight of our Navajo friends living on public domain, he started proceedings which eventually resulted in the extension of the reservation to include this territory in dispute. When we returned to Arizona, these two Navajos had some amazing stories to tell about their adventures in the white man's domain. And Touching Deal, who was the more eloquent, related his saga with great gusto. And the most incredible tale of all was about that huge giant kettle where a man could wash himself all over with soap and warm water and be just as clean as you would be after a full hour in the Navajo crochet hogan, the Navajo sweat hogan, where the hot rocks and steam serve the same function, but with far less comfort and complete satisfaction. The title of this story is Eritrea in a Trading Post. During the years that I worked in trading posts on the Navajo reservation, I had a unique opportunity to observe these remarkable people, to learn about their likes and dislikes, and very much about their methods of dealing with the white man. Sometimes it was comical, and other times it was a little less so. I remember one case of a couple of women who came into the store with a sack of wool. I put the wool on the counter and examined it for quality. It had no sand in it. It was nice, clean wool. So I put it on the scales and weighed it. After I determined the value of the wool, I gave them several dollars and took the wool back into the storeroom. When I returned to the counter, They were looking over some jewelry in a showcase where we displayed rings, bracelets, and other items of Navajo jewelry. Then they asked me to examine a group of rings. There were 12 in that particular group, so I picked them up and laid them on the counter in front of them. For perhaps 10 or 15 minutes, they examined those rings minutely. They picked them up and scrutinized them carefully and looked them over. And then finally they pushed them back and said, "We don't want any." When I put them back in the showcase, I noticed that there was one ring short. I had given them 12 rings, and there were only 11. In fact, one ring had mysteriously vanished. I gave no sign that I had discovered that one ring was missing. And these women went over in a corner and sat down together. I paid no attention to them as they sat there for several minutes. Occasionally, they would dart a quick glance at me as they sat there whispering one to another. So after a while, they got up, came over to the counter, and laid down $4 and said, "Bring us 2 sacks of flour." I went into the wareroom and brought out 1 sack of flour and put it on the counter. Then I said, "Do you want anything else?" "Well, we want the other sack of flour." I said, "What flour?" "Why, the flour we paid you for. We gave you $4. This flour is $2 a sack. We want the other sack." I said, "You didn't pay me for 2 sacks of flour." "Well, we gave you $4. I said, "Yes, that's very true. But that $4 didn't buy 2 sacks of flour." Then they got quite indignant. "Are you crazy? What do you mean $4 won't buy 2 sacks of flour? Now go back and get a $5 sack of flour." "Well," I said, "usually $4 do pay for 2 sacks of flour. But in this case, they only paid for 1 sack." "Well, now how come?" "Well, you know, I gave you those rings out of the showcase. You examined them, and then you gave them back to me. There was one ring gone, and the price of that ring was $2. Now you can keep the ring and the sack of flour, and I'll keep the money, and we'll all be happy." Well, I never saw such indignation in my life. They berated me, they told me what an evil person I was, and that they would not think of stealing the ring. They had never stolen anything in their lives, in fact. And I said, "Well, that's okay. If you want to put it that way, I'm satisfied. I've got my money's worth. I sold you a ring, and I sold you some flour. And we let go just the way it is." So they went back in the corner, sat down on the floor, and consulted and whispered together for quite a while. And at last they came up to the counter, laid down the ring, and said, "Go get us that other sack of flour."
That's wonderful.
This story is titled, "The Boy Who Slept with One Eye Open." In the fall of 1917, I was working in the Indian Wells trading post, owned at that time by Mr. E.J. Martin. For days on end, a certain little-used section of the counter was preempted and occupied by a young man who had been to school for a short period and spoke only a few words of English. He was tall and slender, perhaps 19 years old, and he had his hair cut short. Although he appeared to be sound asleep as he lay on the counter for hours on end, I finally learned that he was sleeping with one eye open. He was, in fact, thoroughly pacing the place, not only the store, but also the entire premises, including our living quarters. This continued for more than a week until a time came when I was to have a few days off for a trip to Flagstaff. When I started to prepare my clothes for the trip, I found that the coat of my best suit was missing, and I was obliged to wear my second best suit. About a week later, after I had returned from Flagstaff, a young man walked into the store wearing my coat. The original buttons had been removed, and in their place were quarters, made by a silversmith into buttons by welding a copper loop on the back of the coin. I asked this chap where he had got the coat, and he said, I bought it from the tall, slim boy with his haircut short. Then I asked, just where is this tall, slim boy with his haircut short? And he replied, he is living with his uncle, 3 miles south of here. The uncle's name was the Carnegie he gave, and he was a good friend of mine. I told the wearer of my coat that the garment had been stolen, and that he would have to surrender it to me, which he did without any objection. Then I cranked up the Model T Ford and started for the Hogan of the Carnegie game. I arrived at the Hogan just before dark, went inside, and found the Carnegie game seated on a sheepskin. I asked him, where is the tall, slim boy with his hair cut short? He said, I see me. What are you wanting for? I said, I'm going to take you to jail in Holbrook for stealing my coat. He answered, so, stop. No. We sat in silence for several minutes. And then I asked, where did he sleep? The Carnegie gave pointed to a row of sheepskins and blankets in the corner. Then I asked, do you think it is good for him to steal? This time his answer was prompt. No, I absolutely do not think so. Then, I said, we have good reason to believe that he has stolen other articles besides my coat. Now, I believe that if you look through his baggage, you will find some of them there. After a moment's hesitation, the Carnegie unrolled the baggage and began his search. Finally, he found a small cloth sack that contained 2 pocket knives, an airbrush, a necklace, and several other small articles that had been missing from our rooms. Being an honest man himself, the Carnegie Gay turned to me and said, I'm sorry about this. Very well, I replied. Then go fetch the tall, slim boy with his hair cut short, so I can take him to jail. Without a word, he went through the door, into the darkness outside. In about 20 minutes, he came back through the door with the boy following him. I took the boy outside, seated him in the Model T, and hobbled his legs to the clothesline, so he could not give me the slip and dash away into the darkness on our way to Holbrook. I adjusted the hobbles so they were about 30 inches long, thus permitting him to walk but not to run. Our room to Holbrook cost the maroon wash, a wide channel with deep sand. Several times the Model T stuck in this deep sand, and I went to work with a shovel to free it, while my prisoner sat in comfort on the seat. When we arrived in Holbrook, about 11 p.m., I delivered the boy to the deputy sheriff in charge. In due time, he came to trial and freely confessed to all the thefts in charge, and the judge sentenced him to 1 year in the state penitentiary at Florence. The following spring, I enlisted in the Army for service in World War I, and eventually went to France with the ADF. I returned to the New World in March 1919 and heard the outcome of this affair. The tall, slim boy with his hair cut short had served his full sentence and come back to his uncle's domicile. But he was no longer slim, for the prison fare had filled out his frame remarkably, and he was not completely barred. For the first day he spent in Indian Wells, he enriched himself to the tune of several eggs taken from our chicken house. From the time I was 4 until I was 20, I lived on the Navajo reservation in a missionary atmosphere. My father had been the first Protestant missionary to the Navajos, and as the years passed, more and more missionaries came out to join his staff and carry the gospel to the heathen. My intimate contact with Navajo children for many years had given me an excellent command of their tongue. In fact, I spoke it fluently and with a flawless accent. At the age of 13, 14, 15, my services as an interpreter were in great demand by some of these missionaries. They had come long distances to try to save the souls of these heathen, but not knowing the language of the heathen, they were unable to do anything without my help. So, as I have said, they impressed me in the service, and much against my will, I went out and interpreted while one of these missionaries preached the gospel to the poor heathen. Now, one of the worst of these two dominions was a man named Adokai Tso. That name Adokai Tso means the big gambler. And the big gambler was big in many ways. He was large and frail, not so tall, but heavily built and powerful of muscle and limb. He was also big in his operations. He had an uncanny skill with cards, and his less fortunate tribesmen contributed to his wealth until he became enormously wealthy, with perhaps 3,000 head of sheep and 200 head of horses. And what's more, Adokai Tso had two wives and about 20 children, and they waited on him hand and foot. He was, as a matter of fact, the top man on the totem pole in that part of the reservation. Of course, the missionaries regarded this man with great sorrow, because he was committing just about all the things in the book, which meant that he was going straight to hell, and it was their deep concern to try to save that soul with him from going to the fiery pit. So they had tried on many occasions to persuade this man to leave the path of iniquity, to get on the straight road, and to follow that road until he came to the pearly gates of heaven, instead of going to hell, where he was already headed. Well, he would always listen politely, of course. All Navajos are polite and diplomatic. But he went right on gambling, he went right on winning sheep and horses and cattle and saddles and saddle horses, until he became perhaps the wealthiest man in that part of the reservation. Time and again, the missionaries tried to convert him. He held to his own way. On one occasion, there was a missionary. His name was Albert Biggs. And he was a native of Australia, and he had been a missionary in China. Well, he went to the Navajo reservation to try his hand at missionizing out there. But he didn't know one word of Navajo. So one day, my father came to me and said, "Mr. Biggs is going over to talk to Adokai Tso, and you go with him in service." I was about 14 years old at the time, and I almost revolted because I didn't like this business of research and forcing religion down the throats of these unsophisticated youth. Anyhow, I was compelled to go with Biggs over to the Hogan where Adokai Tso lived. We arrived there and left our horses out in front of the Hogan and walked inside and sat down. For about 15 minutes, according to the general customs of the Navajos, we sat there in silence. Then we got up and walked over to the man we were visiting, stuck out our hands, and said, "Hello, Mr. How are you, my friend?" So then we sat there for another 5 minutes, and then we began to talk to him. "How are the sheep? How are the cows? How are the horses? How are his two wives, and how are his 20 children?" We had just a nice neighborly chat before we came to the point of our visit. Eventually, the ice was broken, so Mr. Biggs said, "Now you tell this man that he is going to hear a very marvelous story which I will tell him."